Thank you. Marshall, please call the calendar. And court to order.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes Jr. presiding.
Thank you. And just a clarification there for this panel, we have reconstituted and we have myself, Chief Judge Susan Siegel, and Chief Judge Diane Bradfold. Judge Siegel is substituting for Judge Frisch on this. Good afternoon, everyone. Today is Wednesday, October 6, 2021. This is the third of four oral cases for today's calendar. We have six cases on this calendar, two non-oral. This case is case number A21-0627, Ramsey County Attorney versus $1,039,630. It's so much, I can't even say it. We are recording this, so no other recordings are permitted. We will be observing all the rules of court other than the fact that it is being held virtually. We appreciate you attending virtually as well. We will have 15 minutes for appellant's arguments, followed by 15 minutes for respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant, if you so choose. The clock, there is a clock there. You should be able to see that on the screen. And make sure you watch that so you know what the time is. If we do run into any technical difficulties at all, we'll make sure that we make any accommodations for that. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin. Please state your name for the record and the party that you are representing.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Charles Klass, C-L-A-S, and I am representing petitioner Jalal Mueen in this appeal. Prior to today's hearing, we have filed an appellate brief which raised two issues. First, that the district court erred in applying the legal burdens in play in this case. Second, that the district court erred in ultimately finding that the cash at issue was proven to be proceeds of the convicted activity which Mr. Mueen was convicted of. I would first like to start with our first issue raised and speak on arguments made by respondent in their brief. At this time, I would like to clarify and agree with respondent that we do believe that the district court in this matter did make the necessary legal findings and apply the proper burdens, legally speaking, at the district court level. Specifically, we do agree that they properly first considered the question of whether or not the cash in this case was proven by the county to be proceeds of the convicted activity. And then second, they went on to consider the affirmative defense of innocent owner raised by claimant in this case. That being said, despite the agreement that ultimately the correct legal findings were met, we still believe that the district court erred both in the application of the burdens in this case and in their ultimate factual findings. I will let the court know that these issues, as I argue them and have thought about them, have become somewhat blurred in our mind, and I will keep them as separate as possible, but we'll also speak on some issues that I see as somewhat combined between the two arguments we are making. I would also like to touch on statute 609.5314, which respondent draws attention to in their brief and ultimately deems as irrelevant in this matter. The reason why we, the appellant, have focused on 609.5314 is ultimately to draw a distinction between forfeiture cases where there is a presumption of forfeiture and forfeiture cases where there is not that initial presumption of forfeiture as we have in this matter. Cases where 609.5314 would apply make sense in the context of forfeiture. If you have cash that is found in physical proximity to controlled substances or in physical proximity to controlled substances, logically, that makes sense that that cash would then be presumed to be forfeited because you have that automatic connection between the convicted activity and the cash that is attempted to be forfeited in that matter. In this case, where you don't have that initial presumption of forfeiture, ultimately a bridge needs to be gapped between the convicted activity, which in this case is sale of controlled substances, and the cash that is ultimately to be forfeited. In this matter, when the district court was applying the burdens that they did in this case, I believe that ultimately they considered the first question of, did the county basically create that legal connection between the two items, along with also considering the affirmative defense that was raised by claimant. What should have happened in this matter is first, that bridge needed to be connected by the district court. And that did not happen. Ultimately—
If I could interrupt you just for a minute, Mr. Klass. So let's assume, I mean, here we've got circumstantial evidence that the state presented. So let's assume that, whether we agree with you or not, let's just assume that the court, or whether you agree with this or not, that the court in fact concluded that the state had met its burden before it turned to the question of, was there an innocent owner, you know, the innocent owner defense. So how do you think the state, just looking at the state's evidence, that the state's evidence was deficient? I mean, acknowledging we, you know, it's circumstantial, but circumstantial evidence certainly can, you know, create adequate evidence, you know, to meet the standard. So where did they fall down? Why? Based just on the state's evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, and I don't mean to bring up 609.5314 again, but just briefly, those outline situations where there is that presumption of forfeiture because we have that automatic connection between the cash and the convicted activity. In this case, where we don't have a connection between the actual cash, I mean, we are talking about proceeds of the convicted activity, which is the only thing to be forfeited in this case. We have evidence that the crime was committed. We have evidence that Mr. Moeen was the owner and is the claimant of this cash and that this was his. The court drew attention to other circumstantial pieces of evidence, namely that it was stored at his sister's home. The state categorizes that as hidden, and for the sake of argument, we can continue using that term, that it was hidden in his sister's home. But I look to the biggest point that is lacking is the actual connection between the sale of drugs and the amount that is actually at issue in the forfeiture. We have evidence that Mr. Moeen did sell drugs. We have evidence that Mr. Moeen received cash in exchange for selling those drugs. We have evidence, though, that the cash that he received selling those drugs, and this is based on investigation by law enforcement, for example, one controlled buy, he sold one bag, received $25 in return. And so the biggest gap is between the convicted activity and the actual amount that is alleged to be forfeited here. And I am not arguing here today that there is not question marks surrounding the cash, generally speaking. But the statute specifically says that the amount to be forfeited needs to be connected to the convicted activity. Questionable cash.
Well, counsel, if I can interrupt you a bit and just focus on some of the circumstantial evidence, it seems to me the district court place some reliance on the information obtained from the tracking warrant, the regular path that was taken by Mr. Moeen between the dollar store, the storage locker, and the sister's apartment. And that in particular, the sister's apartment, he frequented and started depositing cash about the same amount of, at about the same time that he started selling K2. So would you factor in that evidence to your analysis of where the state failed to meet its burden of proof?
Yes, Your Honor. I still would go back to specifically, we have to look at the convicted activity here and what is reasonable to expect from the convicted activity. The sale of K2 is not up for debate here. That happened. We know one K2 bag was sold for $25. The court brought up the storage locker. We also know that trips were made to the storage locker in relation to Mr. Moeen leaving the store. And we know that cash was found at that storage locker, which Mr. Moeen testified to being proceeds of this offense. That cash was around $9,000 total. That makes sense. I don't think we can discount applying logic to the facts that are undisputed here and the cash that ultimately is up for debate to be forfeited. And again, it goes back to the convicted activity. There may be legal question marks over where this cash came from, what is its legal source, things of that nature. Ultimately, when we are deciding the first prong of this analysis, did the state meet its burden in proving that the cash to be forfeited is connected to the sale of K2? Was that met? Question marks about its legal origin may exist, but ultimately the court is to look at and determine, okay, but out of this $140,000 that is at issue here, how are we directly connecting this to the sale of $25 K2 bags?
And now we are. I'm sorry to interrupt, but can I ask you another question? So, let's follow the logic of your argument. You're saying $140,000 that's too much, is what you're saying. There's no way he in a year could have sold that much K2, given the control buy amount. But does it all have to be attributable, or can it be attributable in part under the forfeiture statute under 5311? Because I know the associated property definition says in whole or in part. And so how do we deal with that?
I'm not sure what the ultimate district court finding would have been under that analysis, but I do agree with the proposition just placed in front of me that yes, it can be in part. But that would mean if it is in part that the entire amount should not have been forfeited or should not have been found to have been forfeited by the district court. I acknowledge that there may be issues in terms of, well, then how do you come to an other amount? But ultimately, we're still focusing on the burden that is on the state in this matter in terms of proving up the entire amount. And that is ultimately what is lacking in this case. But yes, I agree that in this case, the district court could have found that at least in part, some of this $140,000 was proven to have been attributed to the sale of K2 in this matter.
Counsel, it seems that there's also more evidence that would support the amount. First of all, that he had been selling marijuana, synthetic marijuana from the dollar store as early as November 2016. So it seems like there's evidence that it's not just, we're not talking about sales just from 1 year. Second of all, the district court actually did not find his testimony credible in terms of the amount of drugs that he had purchased and the amount that he was selling it for. And I realize that you're pointing to one data point, but that's only one data point. There's obviously evidence that there were ongoing sales here. So why, given the credibility determination, we generally do not dispute credibility determinations on appeal, and the fact that these sales have been going on for several years, why isn't that enough to show that the amount forfeited actually was reasonable?
Yes. Ultimately, we agree that the sales were happening for a larger period than just the one controlled by that I've referenced, or even for the duration of law enforcement's investigation into Mr. Mouin. I believe that was proven in evidence. However, the logic still holds that, as the court just stated, if we want to backdate this to a rough estimate of 2016 and consider that this did last over a year, there still was no evidence entered that would speak to a larger operation that would allow Mr. Mouin to have amassed such a great amount of cash strictly through the sale of K2. Again, given not only Mr. Mouin's testimony, which I understand the court found not to be credible, but through law enforcement's own investigation is where I think we should look to prove there needed to have been something more here to, again, connect the ultimately forfeited amount with the convicted activity. I see here that I am running out of time. I thank the court for their time and ask that the court reverse and remand. Thank you.
Chief Judge Siegel, did you have a question you wanted to ask?
No, I'm good. And then I know we've got 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record and the party you're representing. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is James Mogan, M-O-G-E-N, Assistant Ramsey County Attorney. I represent the prosecuting authority who handles the forfeiture actions for the law enforcement agency, the Ramsey County Violent Crimes Enforcement Team. The district court made sufficient findings and actually went through its reasoning pretty well. It identified that the Dollar Plus store in the surrounding parking lot was used extensively for drug dealing, that Mr. Mouin was one of those that used that for drug dealing, that he was convicted of drug dealing. Found that Mr. Mouin made money from dealing synthetic marijuana, that it found that he moved money from there to his sister's house and secreted it in the back closet of a bedroom. The court found that that money was not profits from the dollar store, and that there was no legitimate purpose for that. The court determined that the amounts that Mr. Mouin was claiming to make was unreliable. The testimony was unreliable, and determined that it was possible for the cash to have been from drug dealing, and then concluded that that was a nexus. The court then transferred the burden and gave Mr. Mouin the opportunity to demonstrate that the cash was actually innocent, that there was a legitimate source for it. And after Mr. Mouin attempted to do so, found that not only was his testimony unreliable and incredible, but that he hadn't met his burden.
Mr. Mogan, though, you're talking about the burden of production, right? Not the burden of, the burden stays with the county at all times in this kind of case, correct?
No, Your Honor. It's a good question. The way that the burden has handled is that the burden proof is on the county or the prosecuting authority until they demonstrate that nexus. And once that happens, that's when the affirmative defense that is listed as an innocent owner claim, or is known as an innocent owner claim, applies. And then it's the claimant's responsibility. The burden is on the claimant to demonstrate that, just as any affirmative defense would be applied. Mr. Klaus, in his...
Can you cite me a case? This is not an area I've dealt with a lot. So where is that in the case law? Because I didn't see that. I'm not quite,
Right.
But what's the case to cite to us for that proposition? Because it's not in the cases cited in your brief.
Right. I will need to supplement this. I don't have that. That hasn't been something that we have disputed up until this point about.
Okay. That's okay. I was just wondering if there was, since this is your area, if there was a case you could. But that's
I should, of course, Your Honor. I do this a lot, but I don't have that. Sorry. I wanted to go into Mr. Klaus had mentioned that he doesn't know how the court would evaluate this issue of his. The appellant supports or admits that the $9,000, even though it arises from the same sales of $25 at a time, that is justified as a forfeitable amount without having some direct connection between the cash that comes from each individual sale and the $9,000. But for some reason, the difference between that and $139,000 needs a higher standard. And I would propose to the court that in actuality, the statute does have a way to deal with that. And that is through its use of the switching of the burdens. The court the case law establishes a nexus of the illicit activity and the forfeitable property. And once that nexus is established, once there's a connection there, then the court switches the burden and gives the claimant an opportunity to demonstrate that it is actually innocent, that there, even though there's this connection, that this actually is, or that this portion of it is, and that that they can demonstrate that this $20,000 is actually from a legitimate source, or this $50,000 is from a legitimate source. The district court clearly, heard the testimony, saw printouts from a couple of banks, heard the testimony and claims that this money came from the sale of a convenience store that was sold 12 years before, or eight, nine years before it was seized, and said, I don't believe that. And basically their burden, they did not meet their burden to demonstrate that any of the cash was innocent.
So, counsel, would you also address, I thought there was some testimony by the claimant with regard to a more recent transaction than the 2008 sale of the market. Wasn't there a $50,000 transaction more recently, or am I wrong about that?
I am not familiar with the $50,000. The evidence, as I recall, is he invested $32,000 in the convenience store that was—
Are you talking about the Dollar Plus store or the earlier—
The earlier. And then he invested $32,000 and then he sold it for $70,000. So it really was only $38,000 profit. Mm-hmm. But that was in 2008.
Okay. And as far as you're aware, the record doesn't have any evidence about additional cash transactions as offered to support this innocent owner defense.
No, the only testimony that I can recall is, his claim that he pulled proceeds out of the Dollar Plus store, but that it was unclear from the record as to his relationship at the Dollar Plus. The court found that he was not an owner of the Dollar Plus. I think at some points he had claimed that he was an owner or a part owner in that store, but the district court found that was not true. So I can't, other than that, there was testimony about his income prior to purchasing the Mounds View convenience store and some effort to elicit from him what he lived off of, how he survived over the years.
Counsel, is there anything in the record in terms of number of sales, approximate number of sales a day that had occurred, how many days, anything along those lines?
No, other than the general idea that they had been tracking him for a few months, there was not. And this was, I believe Mr. Mueen pleaded guilty, so there was no criminal trial or findings.
Okay.
So but again, can I ask you just another quick question about the record? So I noticed that I read the transcript from the forfeiture hearing, but so I noticed that you'd have the $70,000 from the sale of the Moundsview store, but if he'd invested half, his net profits might have been only 30 some thousand, but he still at the end would have had $70,000, right? I mean, assuming he'd, you know, unless there was a loan from the bank, which there's no evidence of. I mean, that's why I'm just wondering why that, on what you base that halving it when we're talking about an amount of cash.
Well, Your Honor, I guess I'm pointing out the fact that this was in 2008. He had $70,000, and he had acquired that by a few years earlier, investing $32,000. So, yes, I assume that in 2008 he had $70,000, but the testimony and what the court relied on, I mean, the court actually cited this, was that. He was unreliable on identifying even, you know, living expenses or how he had purchased, paid for rent and food, utilities, car, anything since 2008. So he had testified that during these types of jobs he was making, I think the testimony was $8 an hour, and yet he was unable to explain how he was paying for certain expenses on $8 an hour. And so I guess, Your Honor, what I'm pointing out is that in 2008, he had $70,000, which is absolutely no evidence that he had $70,000 from that when the money was seized. The issue about the providing of the nexus or proving of the nexus is the cases that how these forfeiture actions are handled by all of the forfeiture cases. As Judge Siegel pointed out, the statute is very broad in the forfeitability of property. It's to read it quickly, it's all property, real and personal, that has been used or is intended to use or is in any way facilitated in whole or in part the manufacturing, compounding, processing, delivering, importing, cultivating, exporting, transporting, or exchanging of contraband or controlled substance. In addition, it then defines proceeds as anything that is derived from or traceable. The appellant appears to seek that the prosecuting authority needs to demonstrate a dollar for dollar connection between the sale and the proceeds, the seized property. And that isn't supported by case law. It's not supported by the statute. And the appellant hasn't provided any case law or any basis for this court to determine the nexus. If it isn't, as the court found, a general connection between the illicit activity and the fact that there is proceeds that were traced from that illicit activity. The law is very fair in the fact that it gives the appellant the opportunity to prove that the property actually is innocent. The appellant just wasn't able to do so, and now it wishes to question the district court's findings because it wouldn't make the same decision. So, Your Honors, I'll stand for additional questions, but I have nothing further other than asking you to affirm the district court's decision.
It looks like there are no other questions, so. Thank you, counsel. We'll turn back to counsel for appellants. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You may proceed.
Thank you. Briefly, I wish to touch upon one point raised by respondent, and that's the discussion of the $9,000 that was claimed by Mr. Mouin to be proceeds of the convicted activity. There is a distinction between this $9,000 and the $140,000, and namely, the $9,000 was found in a storage locker, which also contained marijuana and firearms, creating a presumption of forfeitability against that $9,000. Aside from the fact that Mr. Mouin openly claims it as proceeds, even if you set that aside, with that amount of cash, we have a presumption of forfeitability due to its physical proximity to the cash. To the controlled substances. There doesn't need to be this larger drawn out process connecting this cash to convicted activity. Compare that again with what I previously argued of the $140,000 and its connection to the convicted activity. Because it was not found in proximity to controlled substances or other illegal activity, that is where we required this greater burden, this greater connection placed upon the state to connect the two things. I have no further arguments to make, but we'll stand for questions.
I would just like to clarify real quick. So just so I'm clear, you are arguing that there is no nexus, and even if there was a nexus, you have met your affirmative defense.
That is accurate, Your Honor. However, mm-hmm. in this oral argument and in the brief, I think the emphasis on our argument is on the nexus as opposed to then the second question of the affirmative defense.
Okay, thank you. I see no other questions. Thank you both for your briefing and your arguments, both very well done. We appreciate that. We will be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory timeframe, and this case is now submitted. Thank you both.
Thank you.